You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your hosts, Matt Barnes and Julie Kirk. You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes, and I have an amazing guest today, Lisa Matlovich. From Sarnia, Ontario. I'm not sure if you're from... Well, we'll get to that. You're in Sarnia right now.
I'm from Sarnia.
Are you? Okay. Yeah. So Lisa's a registered nutritional consulting practitioner and a registered orthomolecular practitioner with over 20 years experience. Today, we're going to focus on microbiome and myelination and the impact on mental health.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to have you here.
Okay, thanks. I'm great. I'm really happy to be here as well.
We've chatted a few times, and it's always I always wish that I had recorded our conversations because you give me so much valuable information. And I think this podcast is really geared towards mental health practitioners, and we I think seldomly get the information about nutrition and microbiome and genetic aspects. I mean, that's really a growing field.
Yeah.
So it's really good to talk to you and bring this in to our awareness as therapists and social workers. And so this will be a great conversation.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I'm pumped.
Well, one of the things that you brought to my attention probably a year or so ago was Kelly Brogan.
Yes.
And I really went down that rabbit hole of learning about her. So she was a psychiatrist, for anybody that doesn't know that. Was, from what I understand, primarily working with women that were pregnant and suffering from depression and prescribing prescription medications.
Yeah, a lot of postpartum.
And then she basically closed up that practice and has switched into more of a holistic...
She got woke.
Yeah, she got woke. And, so after you told me about that, that opened up a whole world. There's a great Joe Rogan interview that she did. It's about 3 hours long. I don't know if you've heard it.
But, I haven't, no.
She talks about the dark side of pharmaceutical companies and just that, yeah, the best way to describe it is I became woke after listening to that. So nice. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad that she's amazing.
Yeah.
She's like a pioneer.
She really
superhero
is.
Superhero in this world.
And I really... dove into some of her stuff, her newsletter, and then I kind of got caught up on when she was starting to talk about caffeine enemas.
Yeah.
I don't know, that part lost me a little bit. That was the only thing I couldn't...
Yeah, I'm kind of split on caffeine. I think we'll come back to that a bit, but there's a genetic portion that you can't assume what's good for you is going to be good for me, and practitioners that are new to this, and she's fairly new, don't understand the uniqueness of each thing.
Yeah. Fair
but,
enough.
I mean, that's just
one
thing
element
she's doing.
Yeah.
If we wash that away with everything else she's done,
yeah,
I'll give her that one.
Yeah, for sure. So where should we start? Do you want to start talking a little bit about microbiome?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because that's a real passion of yours.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny how I believe things in our lives teach us. And if we're open to the lessons that are given from the universe, whatever you want to call it, we don't really even need to have formal education if we become cognizant of what's happening to us. And so I've always been a big microbiome person. I took a course from Dr. Knight a few years ago. And Dr. Knight is, he's like Dr. Brogan, he's a pioneer in microbiome. And he's at the University of Colorado. He's part of the Human Gut Project. So he determined, I think for some self reasons, and if you saw him speak, you'd probably understand, I think he struggles a little bit with social cues. Brilliant, brilliant man. I think he's funny as heck.
Yeah.
And I just adore him. But I found that probably we all do things that have a self-serving or self-understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So he taught a course on what microbiome does for mental health and the immune system. And we are more critters than we are human cells. So we are more influenced by what is living on us and in us than what our own DNA cells are. I found that fascinating because You think we're just born this very sterile, unique being, and we're not. We're like a planet that's sort of has its own population. And just like what we're seeing with the coronavirus right now, if your population is the wrong species, then it's detrimental. So we have to, in our body, we have to pick the right species. And there's a lot of ways to do that. So if you've had antibiotics, there's a whole theory that you're born with your microbiome. So babies born through a natural birth and come out the birth canal have a better chance of having a healthy microbiome than those born through a C-section. Or those put in an incubator right away. So those at risk and in a very sterile hospital environment. Not that there's anything wrong with that when you're talking life-saving measures. But, you know, there's certain attributes you get from the initial milk and from the birth canal. And if we are born with that microbiome and then we kind of muck with it a bit in the beginning, like with antibiotics, which when I was growing up were given for everything. You got an ear infection, you give an antibiotic. Like my generation was the antibiotic queens. Like we just took it for every willy-nilly. So we're seeing the epidemic now of a lot of people depressed, anxious, and gut. I see a ton of gut issues. One of the questions I always ask when people come in and they're depressed, did you have a lot of ear, throat, nose infections as a child? And that, I don't know if there's a study, but I found that to be a big predictor of mental health issues in later years. And so what happens then when you put those antibiotics in is they wipe out the population, and then the population comes back. Just like your grass, if you have if you don't have the right turf, you'll get more dandelions or more weeds than you will grass. So our bodies are the same. And if you wipe out all the grass, you're going to get a lot of weeds coming in. So with antibiotics, you've gone in and you've round up everything. The first thing to come back will be the strongest, which is usually not our grass. And so you have a lot of microbiome that's not beneficial. And then when we do things like add probiotics, if you don't change the turf, and I'll go back to the grass analogy again, you don't permanently change the microbiome. So it is a difficult thing to reset the microbiome to our birth amount or birth population. So you have to do a lot of work. There was in the 90s when I first started, the big thing was doing a candida cleanse. I don't even do that anymore. I find that that's kind of a waste of time. And that's what Dr. Knight found, was you change the substrate and you can change how you plant the species. So you change the column, I always say you have to set up the guest room and the right guest will arrive. So you always look at changing the guest room. You don't just go in and start killing when you don't know who's going to show up next. So you do prebiotics, get the right fiber going, get the bowel movements going, neutralize the pH. Even something like toothpaste can have a huge influence on your microbiome. And then you start planting the good microbiome, like the good bacteria.
And that would be like a probiotic type of a supplement?
Or fermented foods.
Right.
Or living foods.
Kombucha.
Too. Yeah, yeah, oh, my favorite.
That's a big one. Eh?
Yeah, I know.
Like, doesn't taste the best, but it's...
oh my gosh, I could drink that every day. I love it.
Could you? Something about the, what do you call it, the piece that's at the top.
Oh, the mother?
The mother, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta look past it.
Yeah, you gotta look past that.
So Kombucha Hound in Sarnia has, it's on tap at Greens. Have you ever tried that one?
No, I haven't.
Oh my gosh, that is, and see, kombucha has a bit of alcohol.
Okay.
So those sensitive to alcohol, like I'm very sensitive. I don't drink hardly. So when I get it, I get a little bit of a whoosh.
Okay.
Because it can have up to almost 2%.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's.
So because it's fermented?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's great. Now the ones that, like the Kombucha Hound, I think you have to have less than 0.9% to be able to be sold over, like,
right
in the market.
Unless, right, okay.
But if you make it at home, you can get pretty high quantities.
Hmm.
So that has it, sauerkraut, yogurt, like real yogurt, like, you know, yogurt that you actually is a living yogurt, not stuff that has fruit at the bottom and stuff.
Like a Greek yogurt? Is that real yogurt?
I'm not trying to promote particular products here, but I feel it sound like a commercial.
Yeah.
I use Astro because that's the one that I need to use when I'm making yogurt because it still has alive bacteria.
Huh.
So Astro or the little vials of BioK Plus, I use those primarily. I don't buy anything else but Astro. And I buy the high fat one too because you need the fat.
Okay.
So Greek yogurt's nice as a dessert.
Okay.
But I don't use that for microbiome planting.
Hmm.
And then your prebiotics, like your fibers. So Dr. Knight found that the best prebiotic, which is the fiber on which the probiotic can grab, is chickpeas. And so every time I have a patient come in with, I'm giving away my secrets here. Every time I have a patient come in with microbiome issues, the first thing we do is prebiotics, and chickpeas are one of the things that I use.
Okay.
Not everybody wants to eat chickpeas because you have to need about a half cup a day.
Hmm.
But they're pretty neutral, so you shove them in a lot of things. You can grind them up, make a paste, put them in your smoothie.
Hmm.
Bananas are really good, and okay. Apple peel. There's a bunch of different things you can use to help set up the fiber.
Hmm.
And I had a really interesting thing happen a couple of years ago. I had a guy come in, and his wife brought him because she wanted to see if there was anything wrong with him. Every wife does that. I want to find out what's wrong with my husband.
I want to fix him.
Yeah. The guy's like, I have nothing wrong with me, but I'll sort of, you know, please my wife and get all this weird testing done. So he did some blood allergy testing, and it came back. There was nothing wrong with him. I don't do the testing, but there's a lab that does. So the lab called me and said, there must be something wrong with this guy's sample because there's absolutely nothing that showed up, and we've never seen this. Mm. And everybody has an allergy of something. And so we sent the test away again, and the lab called up and said, okay, this just doesn't happen. This guy has nothing, like nothing. So I asked the guy, and he grew up in India, and he lived off of a lot of chickpeas and a lot of fresh greens, yogurt, some like things here, and some mild amounts of protein, like they were not rich, and rice, very limited diet. Mm-hmm. And he was never sick. Now he's eating a very, I saw him and he's eating a very Canadian diet, and he's starting to get some issues.
Mm.
It's interesting.
So part of it is his his cultural background, the way that he grew up eating, now changing to a totally different culinary palate, I guess, and that changed his microbiome.
Yeah. So he had prebiotics, and so if you take the chickpeas and the yogurt he was eating as a child, he's got the pre and the pro.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting here with Purell in front of us, which is necessity right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we have over-sterilized our bodies, and
right.
Eating dirt is, you know, really good for us. When I took the course, I wrote a final paper on, I called it the Carrot Project. And I suggested that every household grow carrots in their backyard, albeit maybe not in certain areas. And then take the carrots out of the garden and don't scrub them to death. And eat the carrots with, you know, how we used to do as kids, go in the garden, eat them right out of the garden. We don't do that now. We get and we scrub them, we peel them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's certain microbes on the dirt that we are missing. And what kid, I asked my son, like, do you know any of your friends that go into the garden and eat a carrot? No. No kids do it.
Mm.
So something as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
When
you talk about microbiome, can you break it down a little bit? Because I hear people refer to it as gut health. Is that the same? Like, is that a good...
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
Simpler way to put that?
Yeah, so microbiome lives on everywhere. Okay. It lives in our gut. It lives on our skin. So people that have a lot of skin issues, usually it's too acidic and they're getting the wrong bacteria growing.
Mm.
So the best bacteria grow in that neutral 7 pH.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just our gut. It's like people with dandruff. That's very often a microbiome issue.
Mm.
And people with foot fungus, definitely a microbiome issue. So it's the bacteria that are living on our skin are the wrong ones. And so it's not just changing the gut. Like, I do some pretty wonky things with people to get their microbiome balanced, and it doesn't just end at eating chickpeas. There's a lot of stuff you do, and it's getting that species balanced. And so the thing is, as well, once you get it balanced, don't go back to eating crap, and don't go back to, like, you know, using, you know, cheap shampoo. You need to get natural shampoos and not overwash our hair. That's been a lesson for me. We overwash our hair.
Hmm.
I don't want to sort of sound like Brad Pitt. I mean, do wash your hair more than once a week.
But
it is, you know, we overwash things, and we're washing away a lot of our microbiome. So,
interesting. I never knew that it was on our skin.
Yeah.
That's really important to know.
There was a study done in New York for pre-surgical patients where they were finding post-operative infections were really up. So they took a group of people and they did a cotton swab of an antimicrobial up the sinus. So they swirled around inside the sinus cavity on each side. I can't remember the exact amount before. Maybe it was a week every day preceding surgery. And they found that post-surgical infections were down dramatically. And we know that, MRSA, like the staph-resistant or the resistant staph infection, lives in our sinuses. So there's a really good example of something living in another area. And that's where they test medical professionals, is their sinus passages, because that's where we harbor it a lot. So, and in the ears, stuff like that.
And I was reading, when I read, I was wanted to prepare a little bit for this, and I read a bit of the historical background of microbiome.
Okay.
Which sounds like it goes back all the way to Hippocrates.
Yes.
Times, and where they found that there was a correlation between, I think they called it like abdominal visceral or something like that back then, and the connection with mania and melancholia.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's good research, Matt.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool.
Dated
terms for these things, but this has been looked at and seen as being really important for centuries. Yeah.
So there's a few years ago, I remember speaking with a client about this. They went back to their doctor, and their doctor was really upset with me, saying that there was no connection. I mean, this is before a lot of these conversations. I want to always go, uh-huh, later on. But this person had a lot of depression, and I had suggested that there was a lot of gut inflammation, and that was connecting the depression. And they had had irritable bowel for a long time and a lot of gut issues like that. So there's a connection between our gut and our brain called the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve, if it gets inflamed, it used to be, when I first started talking about this, a lot of physicians would say that's so rare, that never happens. Now the conversation is definitely different. I feel a little freer and saying what I've been trying to say for a long time.
Nice.
When you get gut inflammation, the neurotransmitters aren't traveling between the brain and the gut, and you're getting the wrong ones coming up. And then you're also getting, for simplification, I'll just say brain inflammation. That's not really what's happening, but and then the brain kind of goes a little wonky. So I had a gentleman recently who had minimal depression in his life, like we all do. He wouldn't have classified himself as being depressed. He had a colonoscopy, and within weeks of having the colonoscopy, he was suicidal. And he has struggled for the last 2 years. It took about a year of just doing a really high microbiome diet, getting the gut inflammation down. He's now trying to wean off his antidepressants along with his physician's support. And there is a perfect example of vagus nerve inflammation.
That's amazing.
I know, it's pretty exciting.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, and just on a very simple surface level, some of the things I've seen, just down to nutrition. So when I'm talking to clients and we're talking about symptoms, trying to figure out causation and connections to the past and trauma and all this attachment related stuff. But the most blaringly obvious situation I had was a client came in with anxiety, high level of anxiety, but he only really experienced it in the morning.
Okay.
So we're trying to figure this out, like what's going on here, and we're going through morning routine, what are you doing differently in the afternoon? And it all boiled down to every morning he has a triple coffee from Tim Hortons.
Oh my gosh.
So he cuts that out, and his anxiety level is completely reduced.
Oh my gosh, Matt. It's so funny. Like the simplest things, and caffeine. My brother wrote a paper on caffeine a few years ago, and basically he talked about this drug and all the symptoms this drug caused, and should we allow this drug to be legal? At the end of the paper, he said the drug was caffeine. And if we had to look at caffeine right now and analyze it sort of separate from what we know of caffeine, I don't think it would be on the market. I think it has so many hazardous qualities to it. I love my cup of decaf in the morning.
Okay.
And I love it for the flavor and the more the ritual than anything.
Yes.
I don't use caffeine as a drug.
Okay.
And you get people with anxiety,
mm-hmm.
and I see that.
Yeah.
It is sometimes just stupid coffee.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's so simple.
Oh my gosh.
And I guess I'm one of the people that does use it as a drug. I think maybe having a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old, I feel like I have an excuse right now, but.
So I think you're allowed to use it as a drug when you have kids. I probably did as well, yeah. But that's okay.
Yeah.
I'll forgive you.
All right. Thank you. But it must be so rewarding, because I know that experience was for me to be able to just pinpoint one small change that people can make.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not always small. I mean, we're talking about nutrition and diet and, you know, buying more expensive food, yep. and things like that. So it may not be accessible for everybody, but it must be really rewarding for you to be able to pinpoint specific things that are causing these mental health symptoms.
I must say, like, this is going to sound really stupid, but I almost get high from my job sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, a lot of times it is that simple.
Right.
A lot of times it's... I'll just go, why did it have to take 4 years, or why do they have to be on 12 drugs when mm-hmm. it was this?
Yeah.
And it's simple, and it makes me really angry that mm-hmm. I see. So there's genetics involved in caffeine, and there's a huge percentage of people, I think it's about 15% of people, that have a huge problem processing caffeine.
Mm-hmm.
So those people, they don't even realize it, but it causes a lot more of a reaction and a lot more toxicity. And those people don't realize it. So they're taking caffeine, not realizing that the side effects it's doing. And the number of people I see come in on anti-anxiety meds, that it's caffeine.
Wow.
I've lost count.
Hmm. When you, just to kind of go back to the inflammation piece,
because
I'm interested in that. So when you say that the gut is inflamed, the vagus nerve gets inflamed, what typically causes that?
So microbiome is a lot of it.
Yeah.
And food allergies are a big part.
So eating things that you're allergic to, but you may not realize.
Which is huge. And I will stand up and fight anybody that says different.
Yeah.
I think we have a lot of allergies. And I think a lot of allergies are stemming from the fact we had crappy microbiomes as kids.
Right.
So there's a lot of what I call fake allergies that are not allergies we might have been born with.
Mm-hmm.
But we've acquired because our body recognizes a protein is similar to another protein. Hmm. And
would this be something like gluten?
Yeah, so gluten's a big one.
Yeah.
I have a lot of theories on what we'll call non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, I'm celiac genetically, so mine's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people I have come in that have, we'll say, a gluten-like allergy.
Yeah.
They may have not had it their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And something has turned it on. Hmm. So when you have an allergy, what happens is your gut has it's like a tube, obviously, and it has a mucosa lining inside the tube. Outside the tube is your immune system ready to react and sort of penetrate the garden hose if necessary. And so when something comes in that the immune system gets a signal that it's something not of self, which is what an allergy is, it recognizes something isn't supposed to be there, and it will actually like poke a hole to get into the gut to attack and surround. So the macrophages will surround it and try to kill the gluten, we'll say. We'll use gluten as the best example.
Yeah.
And when it goes in, the best way the body defends itself is it covers up the hole with more mucus and inflammation. So the hole's now covered. So you can imagine that happens day after day. Eventually the body gets covered in mucus, or the whole digestive tract will become mucus and inflamed as a protective mechanism to stop this invasion into the bloodstream of this allergen.
Hmm.
When you have, there's inside part of your intestine, these little protrusions that are called villi. And so over time, those little villi almost get flattened or laid down underneath this inflammation. They are our absorption parts. And when they can't absorb, you have malabsorption. So I'll get a lot of people who have allergies that are actually, they may be overweight, because the one thing that does get through is glucose. Carbs get through easy.
Okay.
Nutrition doesn't. So they'll be overweight and malnourished. And they'll have a lot of inflammation, so they'll have joint pain.
Is arthritis connected to that?
Yeah. So when I was younger, I had joint pain. I had some injuries.
Okay.
I did not have the typical bowel issues of gluten. And so I remember thinking way back that I had a gluten allergy, but because I didn't eat a lot of it, I'm kind of a natural food person, It was not diagnosed. It wasn't until genetics came out that I was able to diagnose, and a lot of my weird symptoms, I had skin problems, and I had joint issues. And I mean, those were my symptoms. So I see that a lot in celiac patients or non-gluten sensitivity non-celiac gluten sensitivity people, that they'll come in and say, well, I don't have diarrhea, constipation. You don't have to.
Right.
You can have these other weird symptoms. Hmm. Depression, anxiety are very connected to gluten allergy.
Hmm.
That happens a lot because of what we just talked about with the vagus nerve inflammation.
Right. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I have a family member who has rheumatoid arthritis, and she cut out gluten and her symptoms decreased tremendously.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a cousin, same thing.
Yeah.
And I would say a lot of people I have with allergies or with gluten allergies have been diagnosed with some type of arthritis or fibromyalgia.
Right. Fibromyalgia is something we hear a lot about. There's not a lot of treatment methods specifically for it. I know that I've heard a lot of connections with trauma.
Yes.
And fibromyalgia. What's your take on it?
So I have a term called buckets, and I think fibromyalgia is a bucket. I think it's probably 1,000 different things, but we for speed and expediting the diagnosis, we call it fibromyalgia. There might be some true fibromyalgia cases, but too often people, with celiac, get dumped in that bucket. Trauma causes trauma. Prolonged trauma reduces the thymus gland, so it reduces our immune system. And if you have a poor immune system and you're having an allergy, it's almost like a bunch of workers who have no boss telling them what to do. So allergies kind of just go berserk, and they're not really being directed properly. So trauma can actually result in weird allergies simply by the fact your immune system is not being directed. So we'll see people with fibromyalgia who've gone through a lot of trauma. I think there's also the fact that during trauma, if it's a physical trauma like a car accident, you'll see the immune response has been turned on. And sometimes the body's kind of stupid. It just turns something on and it can't turn it off, especially if there's a subtle allergy. So dairy's one of those ones that I hear, I just sort of cringe, and I try not to give people advice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You must find the same thing.
Yeah,
it's like
for sure.
You're feeling low and you sort of bite your lip trying to say, well, have you tried this?
You really want them to come to their own conclusions, but sometimes it's just hard.
Yes, I know. So I'll have people say, you know, oh, I was allergic to blah, blah, blah when I was a kid, but I grew out of it. It's like, nah, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. It just manifests differently. So if, let's say that person who had a dairy allergy as a child gets in a car accident, and their body as a child had a lot of inflammation. So that's sort of their body's knee-jerk reaction to something like the dairy. When they have trauma, the knee-jerk reaction turns back on. So you'll get inflammation and you'll get crazy inflammation, overreactive inflammation. And then that long-term inflammation, if we go back to what I said about malabsorption, you don't absorb nutrition. And with lack of nutrition, you get demyelination. So your nerves become more sensitive. So you end up with a lot of nerve pain. Plus the nerves start to go overreacting. They kind of go a bit crazy. So then you end up with neuralgia.
Okay. There's like four pathways I want to go down right now.
I know.
one of them, you just talked about dairy. There's a documentary on Netflix that's really critical of dairy. And so can we talk about dairy for a minute?
Absolutely.
Okay. From your perspective, what, I don't know what the best way to ask this question is. What's your thoughts on dairy, I guess, or what's your thoughts on the impact of dairy on mental health or microbiome?
So as humans, we're also genetically different. So there are societies that have been eating and drinking dairy for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
There are societies that have not been drinking dairy for tens of thousands of years. So we're all genetically different on how we've adapted with what our primitive diet was to eating dairy.
Okay.
I'll start with that. So if you get a nomadic tribe where their main thing, there's a tribe in Africa that eats, they show their wealth through their cattle, and they drink the blood of the cows and they drink the milk. That's their main protein source. They're one of, most African American populations have limited ability to digest dairy. So, but those from that particular tribe, they've retained the enzymes. As most of the world doesn't have the enzyme past the age of 4 to digest dairy. Now, I'll sort of back up a bit with that. I eat cheese, but I only eat imported cheese. And that is because there's a lot of inflammation in our cows in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And we feed cattle corn. And over time, you can't feed corn to cattle for very long because it's high sugar content. It messes with them and their microbiome, we'll say. They get a lot of mucus and inflammation. And it can actually cause some... They don't allow the cows to live long enough to really live to an old age where they're going to see irritable bowel in the cow.
Right.
But they get digestive issues. So the milk that comes out of those cows, I have found people that eat North American cheese and are allergic to it quite often can eat European cheese or grass-fed cheese.
Okay.
So I know grass-fed cheese is insanely expensive, but if you treat cheese as a treat rather than a staple,
mm-hmm.
Like cheese slices, they're just plastic and inflammation goo. I'll spend extra money and get a really tiny piece of cheese and really relish it and eat little bits. I don't eat a lot. That's pretty well it, other than the yogurt. But when yogurt is different because the bacteria have taken the milk and kind of manufactured something different out of it. So it changes it and makes it more digestible. I don't drink milk myself. I haven't for 20 years. Oh my gosh. I barely drank milk as a kid because it used to make me really sick. Protein is not, like, you don't need dairy. And I'm glad that the milk, or the food triangle in Canada's changed to reflect that. That we can have alternatives. We use a combination coconut and almond milk. Sometimes a rice milk.
And that's what you did for your son as well?
Yeah. When he was a baby, there was no coconut and almond milk. It was soy.
Okay.
And rice. So I alternated between soy, rice. I did try goat. When the first time he had dairy as a child, he had dairy once as a child in a formula, which is why I started making my own formula. I gave him Similac, I think.
Okay.
And I went into the bedroom and he was smashing his head against the wall, screaming and ripping his hair out.
Whoa.
So I didn't know then he's celiac as well.
Oh,
and
okay.
So a lot of celiac people, dairy's a known trigger as well.
Is that genetic?
Yeah.
Celiac?
Okay. Yeah. So we had him tested.
Yeah.
I sound like Sheldon's mom. We had him tested and his genetics came back. He had, there's certain markers for celiac and he lit up every one of them. And then I let him decide what he was going to do. And after two birthday parties, because we didn't have gluten at home, he went to two birthday parties. And the second birthday party, he had to come home early because he wasn't feeling well.
Wow.
I'll end the explanation there.
Yeah.
But so dairy is something that we don't need as kids.
Yeah.
He's got great bone density.
And that was one of the things that the documentary kind of points out as the marketing strategy that milk has taken. You know, it does your body good. It builds strong bones.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not completely true.
No. It's not at all. It's funny. A few years ago, I went into University Hospital and I have this skirt. It looks like cow skin, but it's a fake cow skin, obviously, me being an animal person. And I guess they had a milk symposium there, and they came running out thinking I was a spokesman from the Dairy Association. And I said, no. And I said, why? And she goes, oh, your cow skirt. I'm like, no. And then afterwards, as I'm getting in the elevator, I'm thinking, dang, I should have gone in and given them my 2 cents.
Mic drop at the end.
It's like opportunity lost.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But no, milk is not. And we have way too much. The whole thing about the calcium magnesium balance, we're supposed to have equal calcium to magnesium 1-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
Right now in North American diet, it's 14-to-1. Too much calcium in our diet.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting things like kidney stones, gallstones, calcification in our joints. I'm not saying that's the whole problem, but if you read anything, there's a book by Dr. Levy, Death by Calcium, and he says that he sees as a cardiologist, mm-hmm. and he sees that a lot of calcium is a major part of our health issues cardiac-wise.
Wow.
I think there's a recognition that if you're getting a lot of mucus from milk, mm-hmm. of course, if you have asthma, it's going to implicate. Of course, it's going to cause, you know, all these mucus problems, sinus issues.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a party trick I have, but I can tell when I'm in a group of people who has post-nasal drip caused by milk.
Hmm.
You can hear it in their voice.
Wow.
I mean, I have to fight not to go up to them and say, cut back the dairy, dude.
Mm-hmm.
But you can almost hear it.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. It's very frustrating, actually.
I bet.
Yeah. But you would probably see a lot of people. Like, do you see people with a lot of mucus and inflammation who are also depressed? Is that a correlation you notice?
I don't think it's ever been on my mind to look at it.
Okay.
I've never been trained in assessing those types of things. And
well, you won't need me anymore.
That's why I refer to you.
It is very simple. And party tricks, if you can almost tell what's wrong with a person by how their voice sounds.
Hmm.
And it's pretty interesting. There's different things that will show up in people's voices.
Hmm.
I'm obviously right now working from home. I do a lot of phone consults,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell over the phone. You get used to listening to different things, and dairy is definitely something that changes people's voice.
Wow. And I always used to, maybe it's an old wives' tale, but look at your cuticles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
is that true? Like, yes. If there's white spots on them, that means you're calcium deficient?
It's more, yeah, definitely more and more I'm seeing that. And zinc deficient as well. And yeah, I do a full nail. I look at people's nails.
Do you?
I look at their tongue. Hmm. I look at their ears and their eyes.
I should probably come for an assessment.
Yeah. You might not want to. I'll have you on chickpeas and beans all day.
Yeah, sorry. We eat a lot of curry, so that's good.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Mexican food.
That's our mainstay
is
Indian and Mexican.
Nice.
And I think the whole meat thing too, like we don't meet every day.
No.
And you know, like everybody's asking, have you stocked up in food right now?
Yeah.
I got bags of lentils in the basement.
Nice.
That we always have.
Yeah, like,
this isn't new for us.
Yeah.
So
we eat a lot of venison.
Okay. So I don't do that.
No, maybe you're against that, but
I feed the deer.
Do you?
I'm not against it. I'm actually more for that than eating. I was a vegetarian for a long time, and then I met my husband, and he was a farmer, grew up on a farm.
Okay.
So it was really hard to cook two different meals. I still don't eat most meat. We eat mostly chicken, turkey.
Do you? Nice.
Or fish. Fish is pretty much our mainstay.
Yeah. Nice.
I make what I call ground beef, but it's not beef.
Yeah.
So
I just noticed the difference with beef and venison.
Oh yeah.
The processing of beef is so much longer for me.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And it hurts sometimes, and yeah, it's just really gotten away from ground beef or beef in general.
But it's really hard. So even worse is pork. Hmm. Pork is almost impossible for humans to digest properly, and it takes forever. So
wow.
I haven't had pork since I was 9 years old.
Wow. Can we talk a bit about your background?
So
we don't have to get too deep into it, but just how did you, I kind of skipped this question. Usually we ask it off the bat, like how did you get to where you're at now? But you've always had an interest in nutrition, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Maybe as a result of being celiac or?
No, I had, I'll sort of shout this to anyone that'll listen. I had the coolest grandparents on the planet. My grandpa was one of those super geniuses that made everything. He was a shop teacher, but he was so much more. I think if he was born today, he'd be a computer engineer. I've got clocks in my house, a beautiful grandfather clock that he made everything right down to the numbers.
Cool.
Like it's just really cool guy. My grandmother was, before she met my grandpa, a cook by profession, and she ran the kitchen at a hospital.
Hmm.
So back in like the 20s and 30s, hospital kitchens were also their pharmacy. So I grew up like going out to the yard and picking weeds and knowing what to do with them.
Cool.
She made poultices. I don't even remember like half the stuff that she made, like homemade cough medicine.
Mm.
So it was through her that I learned everything she would say was, what would tummy like? And that was her saying. I know it's kind of childish, but I always go back. I can hear her voice in my head.
Cool.
So I was going through to be a pathologist, and I got in a really, really bad car accident. And I wasn't able to complete going through medical school. So a fellow, a friend of mine who was a physician at the time said, well, you know a lot about nutrition. Take what you've learned so far and apply it to a slightly different direction. Of course, when you're going through something, you get really angry thinking, I don't want to give up my dream. But it was a great suggestion because it brought out things that intuitively I just know.
Mm.
And now the medical training and the nutrition have sort of melded into one thing.
That's a great, yeah.
Yeah.
You work with First Nations people for a while.
I do.
And you did some research as well.
Yep.
Remember you saying at Walpole?
Yeah, my first undergrad thesis was on the health of Walpole as it relates mostly to mental health and I guess what their pressures are from society in that.
Okay.
And that was, I have Native ancestry in me, so it was a very, I still get choked up thinking about what First Nations people have had to endure.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done work on Kettle Point.
Okay.
I like working with First Nations. I guess I just get them.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And when you're working with different cultural backgrounds, are you often going back to the historical diets that they had?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess this is a good sort of lead into genetics.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
So we are all basically a result of our ancestors. So we have the ability to digest enzymatically based on what our ancestors were doing. Evolution in humans enzymatically is pretty slow. So things like margarine, our bodies have no idea what to do with it. We don't have enzymes for margarine. I mean, you know, we have enzymes to deal with olive oil, and it's something we've done for thousands of years. So if you look at the diet that's best for each person, it sounds strange, but one of the things I always ask is, what is your ancestral background? And I ask that of most people that come in. And if I get, you know, Scottish, English, Irish, okay, well, I know, you know, just, you know, the pretty standardized North American diet with potatoes, meat, vegetables, and a little more fish than we actually should be. We should be eating more fish. Somebody comes in and they're Scandinavian, I will go with heavy fish, nuts, berries, and some greens. And like, I feel best with my native ancestry. I could live off blueberries, salmon, and nuts. And that would be the perfect diet for me, and wild rice.
Nice.
If I eat a lot of carbs, I just feel really crappy, like breads and stuff.
Okay.
So my husband's Eastern European.
Mm-hmm.
So his diet is a lot of root vegetables and meats. Ancestrally, he would eat a lot more meats. Natives traditionally ate more fish and venison than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks they ate mostly venison. It was actually a lot of dried fish, because that could be kept all year round. But Eastern European is pretty heavy in a lot of the meat.
Mm.
So you have to look at what, remember I was talking about the milk thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
First Nations people didn't have milk.
No.
No wonder I can't drink it.
Yeah.
And you have to look at that. Okay. You have to look at how you, and that would have set my ancestral microbiome. So it's, if you think about it, that some of the colonies of my mom was actually German and English, Scottish. And if you look at the microbiome I got from her, that microbiome is inherited for thousands of generations. So it's kind of like passing down seed.
Mm-hmm.
You think of, you have colonies on you that were on your great, great, great grandparents.
Mm.
That's kind of humbling.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
I hear sometimes people getting their blood tested.
Mm-hmm.
And basing diet around blood type.
So it's, that would work if we were very stringent in our isolation of like races. I found 25 years ago that was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing only because of, you know, we'll say mixed race, where nobody, like my genetic DNA, my ancestor DNA, I look like the United Nations. So to pick what would be the best blood type for me,
yeah,
who knows?
Okay. So that's not as accurate as just looking at ancestry.
It was, but not as much.
Okay.
It's changed, unfortunately. Huh. Not unfortunately. I mean, I think eventually we'll just be one race.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going that way. I see it as a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're getting some, there's some benefits that each race brings. And I think that we can really become a stronger species.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How did you get into the mental health side of nutrition, and or did that just come naturally with as it, you started to learn?
So as you probably know, mental health issues have escalated. Maybe it's the dialogue is changing. When I first started, I would get women coming in and they'd be hesitant to say they were depressed.
Hmm.
Now they come in because they're depressed. I would say a lot of it was probably just, I'll admit, like, I'm an addict. My addiction is education. Right now I'm taking a course on the COVID-19 virus that's out of the London Imperial College, which is the one that's doing all the meta-analysis. And so when I get stressed, I take a course. But so I've taken so many courses, and I think, I can't even tell you, Matt, I don't know what the answer is to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the microbiome course changed my life.
Yep.
And the genetic training through Johns Hopkins, that really changed my life.
Mm.
Genetics is, oh my gosh, I could almost start jumping up and down right now, because genetics and microbiome are everything.
Mm.
Everything. Mm. Like, in the future of medicine, you will be treated for your genetics and your microbiome. That will be mental health, heart disease, everything.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And I know in my field, epigenetics is a growing term that we're learning more about.
Cool.
Can we talk about the connection with epigenetics and myelination?
Methylation.
Sorry, methylation.
Yeah, which actually is it has a relationship to myelination, okay?
Okay.
So we're born with DNA. Everybody has like thousands of pages of errors. So if we were to take all of my errors and put them on paper, we'd have a couple thousand pages of errors.
Errors meaning?
So each, when you have a sequence of DNA, so I remember it by CATG, so cat gut. So CATG are the bases, and each gene should have a pair of bases. So let's say it's supposed to be C's, and one of my C's gets displaced and becomes something else. That's an error. And that happens through inheritance. An error where something flips when my DNA was being formed, or a chemical transplant of DNA in another spot where it splices into the wrong position. So trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome, three copies of 21 shows up. That's an error. So we all have errors. So that genetics means that protein in our body is made based on these bases. The bases are like the instructions.
Okay.
Okay. So these instructions tell our body to make a certain thing or do a certain function, or this cell should become a certain thing. And there's stop in each instruction. There's also stop and go parts. Like, I'm just going to use it. Let's make a skin cell. And you'll get the code, start, make skin cell, stop.
Hmm.
I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that, but that's mm-hmm. simple. And in epigenetics, it's going in, and because we all have errors, so one of the errors that's, we use schizophrenia.
If you need to get that, we can...
No. There's an error for schizophrenia.
Yeah.
There's a lot, actually.
Is there?
There's a lot of what they say make you more prone to have a schizophrenia. There's not one schizophrenic gene.
Can errors be modified?
Yes.
And that's...
Epigenetics.
That's epigenetics. Okay, gotcha.
So we have a genetic error.
Yeah.
What acts on that error to turn it on or off is the environment, and that is what epigenetics is.
Right. The nature, nurture can turn it off and on.
Yeah.
Okay, makes sense.
Exactly.
It was explained to me that, I guess an example of epigenetics is that when our grandmother is pregnant,
mm-hmm.
we're being formed.
Absolutely.
Which was kind of a, for a lot of people when I talk about that, it's like, holy cow, like my grandmother had a really difficult time, or it was during the war, or there's a lot of stress during that time. But I guess that's an easy way of kind of explaining how our genes are created.
Or changed,
right.
Yeah.
Through the environment.
Yeah. So, and we also have, we now know, inherited genetic memory. So I'll go back to myself, for example. Nobody really, like my grandma's long gone, and I can still go into the forest today and figure out what plants do what. And it's not what I've been taught, it's what I know. And I can't even tell you how I know that. Mm-hmm. It's just genetic memory somewhere in me has the ability to go in.
It's cool.
And we all have something. We just don't know. That's where we'll call them gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandma used to say we're all given gifts, and I think we inherit gifts, or we inherit trauma. There's a lot of talk about inherited trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So you know all about this.
Yeah.
If your grandparents go through trauma, then they have kids, you might have some of those phobias, fears. There's a lot of research being done on like mice. You teach a mice how to do something, and then its offspring actually know how to do it without being shown.
Wow.
So
that's cool.
It is cool. I mean, that's what we call evolution, but it's also genetic memory.
Hmm.
And so we get, you know, there's a lot at play with genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just that we look at that. I get so excited because there's a whole do you know what CRISPR is?
No.
So CRISPR is the ability to splice the perfect code into an error. So there's I'm going to predict. See, like, I'll be like Gene Dixon. By 2025, I think we'll be treating most genetic errors with CRISPR or splicing. So things like the low-hanging fruit are MS and cystic fibrosis. So they'll be able to go in and splice the perfect gene over top of the defect gene that causes cystic fibrosis.
Whoa.
And treat it maybe before we're born.
Can we just go back to the schizophrenia?
Yes.
Because I remember you telling me you went to a schizophrenia training not too long ago, maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you learn about schizophrenia?
Well, I actually did my master's thesis on B12 and its manifestation for schizophrenia and mental health.
Oh, really?
So it's kind of I spent 3 years studying methylation, which is one of the big parts of schizophrenia.
Hmm.
And back when I did my master's, again, I mean, I wish I could have published greater because it was kind of poo-pooed back then because it was 2000 and I think I finished in 2004 and it was kind of like out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we know that a lot of things that turn on genes are epigenetic markers. So the marker for schizophrenia is really related to methylation. Methylation is the ability to protect a gene from, I'm going to simplify this, damage,
mm-hmm.
or from turning on.
Okay.
So there are a bunch of things that methylate, and this is why I'm a sheet here, because I don't want to forget anything.
Yeah.
Folate, B12, B6, choline, methionine, and polyphenols, and part of what comes in soy as well.
Hmm.
So those have the ability to stop certain genes from coming on, specifically ones that need methylation. So methylation is, it's a whole process that happens that protects genes from damage or from starting up. So it's like putting a blanket over a mouse on the floor and the mouse can't get away, but you have to keep the blanket there.
Okay.
The moment you take the blanket away, you can manifest it differently. And so schizophrenia is one of those ones. And a lot of times schizophrenia, it manifests later in life because it takes a while for the gene to turn on. There's a lot of theories now that's because it takes that long for the for lack of methylation to allow the gene to become damaged.
Hmm.
And once it turns on, it's difficult for schizophrenia to be turned off.
Do psychoactive drugs turn it on? Or is that that's a theory, isn't it?
So anything that causes chemical changes in the body, chemical exposure,
mm-hmm.
certain medications decrease methylation. So a really good example, and I'm going to probably get in a lot of hot spots for this, but this is what's happening. A lot of the acid suppressors turn off the parietal cells in the stomach. The parietal cells are what absorb B12. And when you turn off those parietal cells, you actually make the patient automatically almost unable to absorb B12.
Hmm.
So when I get kids in that have been on acid suppressors because they have a high stress level, or they have celiac and they don't know it and they have stomach issues and they're on a protein pump inhibitor, mm-hmm. and now all of a sudden they're getting symptoms of schizophrenia, it's because they have been denied B12 for a long time.
Hmm. What's an acid suppressor?
So it turns off the acid in the stomach.
What would be an example of that?
Like there's different ones. There's
like it's a medication.
Yeah, it's a drug. Yeah, okay. Pharmaceutical drug.
Okay,
and gotcha. it's for reflux gut burning.
Hmm. Like not like a Tums, but more of a prescription version of that.
So they're called proton pump inhibitors.
Okay,
and they turn off the ability of the stomach to make acid. So the same cells that make acid are the same ones that make the little raincoat that allows, it's called the intrinsic factor, that allows B12 to be absorbed. So you're turning off two functions. So when you put people on a PPI, you're supposed to monitor their B12. I rarely see people that are monitored. I want to pull my hair out because then they end up with a lot of demyelination, which is nerve damage from lack of B12. And demyelination from lack of B12 can be permanent. And you end up with like peripheral nerve damage, like tingling in both hands and feet. Mm-hmm. And you end up with depression, anxiety, and in worst cases, it can, I'm going out on a limb here, trigger schizophrenia.
Hmm. Wow.
There's a theory that anything that changes the ability to absorb B12, B6, choline, all the ones I just mentioned, removes the protectiveness that our body has for schizophrenia. So you can carry the schizophrenic gene and never have it. Like, I actually carry it. I'm going to disclose that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it, but I carry it. But I grew up in a household where, I mean, we were eating like crazy organic vegetables from the time I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so the likelihood of me getting it turned on was almost nil.
So you can test specifically for that gene?
Yeah, so when I took the course, like I've taken courses on genetic analysis,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm not a geneticist, and I don't do genetic counseling,
yep.
but I have people come in and they bring their genetic code file. We plug it into these super duper readers that I have, and I can tell exactly what foods they should be eating more of, what foods they should be eating less of, what drugs they're able to metabolize, and which detox pathways they have, and which methylation errors they have. So it's not as simple as just taking B12. If you have a methylation error, there are certain types of B12 you need to take.
Okay.
So that's where it gets really complicated and you need the genetic code.
Hmm. Okay, because you hear B12 as a common supplement that people take.
Yeah, but if you take the wrong one, you can clog up the pathway and the damage will still occur.
Wow.
So it's complicated.
And B12 is connected. So we shared a case.
Yes.
Of a young woman with severe acne.
Yes.
She was seeing me because of the impact that was having on her social life and her mm-hmm. mood and things like that. So I sent her to you. And what did you find around B12?
Massive deficiency.
Okay.
So, and this is one thing I also say, blood tests are not always accurate, because if we'll go back to the analogy, you're using the wrong one, you're getting B12 in, your blood tests are going to show you got B12. But if it's not methylated, like if you can't turn on the B12 and make it methylated, you could have crazy high levels. You can actually have high levels and have a deficiency.
Hmm.
So I don't know what exactly the levels were for this young woman,
mm-hmm.
but you can tell by the tongue and the symptoms that B12 is lacking in the diet. So we put B12 in and energy is coming back. Acne is the surface, but it's not the root. So it'll probably be the first thing to disappear. But the young woman is starting to feel better, has more energy, and is less depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thing. Depression and B12, well, any of the methyl factors, like the B6, all of that. If you have toxicity in the brain, you're going to be depressed. And if you have, so when the best way to describe demyelination is our computer cords and how we use computer cords to communicate to, our printer. And the signal from our computer goes to our printer. And if we were to take a knife and cut into that computer cord and remove the plastic coating, that signal may not get through to the computer properly.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, and it's visual. People can look at it. Mm-hmm. So if you take your nerve cells, which have a little plastic coat, not plastic, but mm-hmm. a coating over them, and you rip away that covering, which is what's made by B12, those nerve signals can't get properly. So the communication between the synaptic gap of the cells gets diminished, and I see a lot of chaotic thinking in people who have a lot of defective cellular brain communication, because their coatings aren't working properly. So the signals just land willy-nilly. I'm oversimplifying this.
No, that's a good way to put it, though.
Yeah.
And so as the B12, for this client anyways, does the B12 mm-hmm. levels come up?
Yeah.
The skin reactions start to decrease. The acne goes away.
So, I mean, we're also doing microbiome stuff, too.
Okay.
So there's that.
Right.
And we're doing, like, all the teenagers that I get coming in with acne, one of the big things is doing some getting off, like scrubbing like crazy, and doing things like a gentle baking soda wash, which is pH neutral.
Okay.
And using a baking soda toothpaste, which is pH neutral.
Mm.
Using a lot of chickpeas and like a probiotic. And then adding in your B12, your folate, and your B6, which they come as a package. And then eventually the skin will start making itself perfect again. As well, you can't get red blood cells that provide oxygen without proper B12. So if you can't have oxygenation, you end up with all kinds of bad bacteria landing on the skin. So you have to have proper oxygenation. So that's sort of the double whammy of no B12.
Wow.
It's lack of oxygen transport.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Really coming at it from multiple angles.
Yeah.
B12 being one of them, but
I love B12.
Yeah.
It's the coolest of the vitamins.
Yeah. I didn't know that there was variations of it.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
So that's good to know.
Yeah. So it gets a little complicated, and that's where the genetics is good. I mean, I kind of guessed before I did the genetics,
mm-hmm.
but the genetics just, man, that's sort of circumvented months of guessing.
Yeah.
I just go right to the guts and the glory, boom, we're done.
Nice.
And probably shortchanging myself some money of consults, but I get people in and out a lot quicker.
That's great.
Yeah.
And what other service providers or practitioners would you collaborate to treat your clients?
I work with a lot of physicians now, which I didn't 20 years ago, so that's been a big change.
Hmm.
I love working with mental health professions like yourself. I have, a good relationship with all of them, because most of us are on the same page.
Yeah.
We're not in this to prescribe drugs. I don't like giving a bunch of supplements. I like giving people food options first.
Mm-hmm.
Supplements are fast and easy to get people better quicker, but I think we have the same goal. And I guess a lot of chiropractors, and there's a couple of osteopaths in town I work with a lot. And I work with a couple of the naturopaths.
Hmm.
There's a dietitian that's kind of, she's been training with me, because when I retire, she's going to take over my practice.
Nice.
And I'm very close to her, and we have a very similar outlook. But I don't work with a lot of other nutritionists, because the way I work is not your average nutritional training.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm kind of very unique. There's a person in Toronto that kind of works like me, but there's nobody really does the weird things that I do. So
we're lucky to have you.
Well, no, I'm just weird.
Yeah.
But it's different ways to look at things, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's so helpful for us as mental health providers to be able to give the psychoeducation to people.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about birth trauma in an roundabout way. There's a huge influx of people scheduling C-sections. I know that's a big thing in the States now, not wanting vaginal deliveries. But I think too, at least in my training with trauma therapy, is we're taught to go back to pregnancy, what was going on in the house, and what was the birth like.
Excellent.
Which was something I never had thought about prior to doing that training. To really understand, was there complications? Was it traumatic? You know, was there health issues? You know, what was going on during that time?
Wow.
So that's cool for clients to be able to go back and say, you know, maybe this is part of why my gut health isn't where I want it to be, or why I'm experiencing these symptoms. And I also think too, what you said about methylation and epigenetics helps that conversation with talking about First Nations trauma and the legacy of residential schools. There's a lot of ignorant people out there, and you know, they've had to shut down comments online because of how much racism there is, especially around the blockades. So for anybody not from Canada, there was recently a lot of protests around a pipeline being put in, and you see the ignorance, the racism, but also the misunderstanding. Why haven't they moved past the trauma of residential schooling? Right? Why aren't they healthier?
Oh my gosh.
So this is it's just great information to have, I think. When those conversations inevitably come up.
How can you move past it if you're still living in a world where you're almost looked down upon?
Mm-hmm.
You only will rise up to the people's expectations of you.
Good point.
And we've paternalized First Nations, and we tell them what they can and they can't do, and what they shouldn't do, and what their limitations are, and we give them an allowance.
Mm-hmm.
They'll always be sort of subjugated to the government paternalization.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they're going to feel powerless. I'm realistic. I mean, I'm not anti-industry. I mean, I think I wouldn't have gotten here if I didn't have gas for my car.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to learn to communicate better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
And that's all that it is.
Do you have any advice for people in the mental health field? Social workers, psychologists, therapists? You know, just down to what you had said about, do you assess people's voice or how they talk? You know, things... Is there anything like that we could take out of this from you, that the listeners could kind of take into their assessment skills, or just in how they look at mental health?
So I honestly have been thinking about teaching a course on a physical assessment, which is what they used to teach in medical school. I have this really cool old textbook from the University of Glasgow, and they have this whole section on how you look at a patient, how you listen to their voice, how you look at their cuticles, which mm-hmm. you mentioned, and they don't do that anymore. So if I could say, every person, take the first 10 minutes with someone and just look at their hands, look at their skin, and listen to the sound of their voice. Like if somebody has a really big B12 deficiency, their tongue gets really big, and their tongue actually will get stuck on their teeth, and you'll actually hear it. So if you've ever heard a severe schizophrenic talk, they can barely talk because their tongue is so big.
Wow.
So things like that. Someone who's about to have a stroke, I always say it sounds like they have pennies in the back of their throat. I can tell somebody's going to have a stroke about a month before it happens, just by the sound of their voice. So there needs to be more physical assessment. And I guess that's my advice.
I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
And not something that I've ever been told to do. So I appreciate that.
Well, I don't think any of us... I wasn't in school.
No. It has me feeling really self-conscious about my voice now.
Oh, I don't hear anything.
Okay,
so.
That's good. All right, good quick assessment.
Yeah.
Well, I think everybody needs to find a Lisa Matlovich to have in their back pocket.
With a mat.
Yeah. Do you recommend people in other cities or countries connecting with naturopaths or nutritional consultants? I guess that would probably be a basic thing that you would advise people to do.
So look for somebody that does functional medicine, and look for somebody that has genetic training.
Okay.
And I would encourage everybody to go look up the Human Gut Project.
Okay.
And see the background to the meta-analysis for the whole world of poo. And I think, you know, I know there's other people like me. There's a person in Toronto. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of people that do exactly what I do.
Do you know what the person in Toronto's name is?
I don't. Okay. I heard through my college that there was somebody there.
Okay. So they'd be an orthomolecular
consult? I'm not sure, to be honest. I know they charge $250 an hour, and which is like, I choke on that because I'm nowhere near that.
Yeah.
I do a ton of online consults, which is why right now, this whole isolation thing, I'm still working.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you are.
Yes.
You can still talk to people. And so I've been doing that for a long time. So I have people all over the world.
Cool.
So I have clients. I have a client in Vancouver. I have a client down in California. I have a client actually in Colorado that I'm talking to 2 weeks from now. So
nice.
I don't find that space really limits, but you need to talk to somebody who is functional. And you need to have somebody that understands microbiome and genetics.
Okay.
There was a doctor in London that we shared a patient with, and he actually called me and said, you are 20 years ahead. And if people would just understand what you're trying to get across, he said, we could prevent. And this was a physician. I just fell over.
Wow.
And I think that's it. And I think doctors, there's a couple in town that get genetics. I have one that sends people to me when he doesn't understand it because he knows it's something weird. And that is like, that's awesome. We need to look past symptomatic medicine.
Yeah, great point.
Well, for depression, depression's not just depression. Depression is a manifestation of years, epigenetics, environment, trauma. I mean, have you ever found anybody that's just depressed and that's it?
No.
No. So everything's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how would people be able to reach out to you, to contact you if they want more information from you?
So my website is www.healthyone.ca, and it's the numerical one, not the word one. So healthy with the number one.ca.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh my gosh, I had fun.
I'm going to have to do this again.
Absolutely.
When everything unwinds with this corona. But well, it was great to have you, Lisa, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Matt.
This podcast is brought to you by Southwest Counseling Services and Julie Carter Counseling Services.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.